thaw index at the top of the insulation, which we had tested to start with. Depending on, actually all this is just a temperature gradient across the product, knowing where the freeze thaw is going to occur within the cross section or the insulation. And finally, with all the data that they finally got after almost 3 years, Dow Chemical and Purdue University devised a computer simulation of ropeheads. In other words, to be able to sit down and tell you how much gravel versus how much insulation, to get a certain maximum output of what you're building with. And that is available. We're still using that. It's been upgraded over the years, but we still have that computer simulation of building the roads. It's been used quite a bit. After that, they took their computer model and went out to test it against the field, actual field situation. And you can see that the computer model measured very, very close to exactly what the field data was. So they were right on target with their work. So basically what they've done is come down with a family of acceptable designs, and you can see the differences is the gravel versus the thickness of the insulation as we go from the left hand all the way to the right. This is a typical cross section of insulated pavement design. You have the flexible and the rigid, which is just the concrete versus the pavement. And you can see where we've placed the insulation. Any questions yet on that? This is more up north. This has to do with the permafrost. Let's back up. In this situation, you see what we're doing is we're stopping the heat flow from below the ground. And in this situation, we're stopping the heat flow from coming down and disturbing the permafrost. So basically, it does either way. Okay, the construction of the flexible and also the rigid pavements. We'll get into a little bit of application here quickly. Subgrade is being prepared and being leveled. And typically what they do is they'll take a line before they lay the rigid insulation so that it'll be straight and true, and then again to lay it. Now, two critical things when they do this is that they stagger all the joints. As you can see, the joints are staggered from here to here. And what they're doing here is they're placing a wood skewer into the ground. It's a pressure-treated wood skewer just to hold the insulation in place. We're now, because of the joints and also field installation, in most applications that we do now, we actually put two layers and stagger all the joints. So if the design criteria is like 4 inches, instead of putting 4 inches of rigid insulation, we'll go 2-2s. Have a continuous monolithic piece of rigid insulation below, which you found to be much better. Let's see that going there. This is up on Turnigan Arm. Right. See that? The interesting point on this slide, while we took it, was you can see that we don't have insulation here. It's a very poor area, soil area for frost. And so it was thought that here's where we want to insulate. And what they'll actually do is taper this insulation into the conventional system so that there's not a dramatic change occur in that area.
All of that has to be put in by hand, right?
Yes, sir.
There's no mechanical way of putting that stuff down yet.
I can't go forward on this vessel. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the insulation. No, it's all got to be put down by hand. Extruded polystyrene is extruded. It comes from a basic polystyrene powder that's extruded to a dye. And unlike urethanes that you can actually froth or spray, extruded polystyrene you can't. It has to be made in a controlled atmosphere, in a controlled roadbed. Urethanes, though, can't really be used in roadbed because of the moisture pickup and they can't take much freeze thaw. So they tend to disintegrate underneath the roads. Now, the next step in this is all we do is we start to load the board with the aggregate. We don't like to see the trucks drive on the board, but so they back onto a dump and then just keep pushing back and just grade it right back over the foam. Also, we use that not up here that I know of. In Montana and Wyoming, we use it as just. How's he back up? It's not a little forward. There we go. As soon as I walk back here to it, then it'll do it. It's an overlay. And basically, it's the same principle. All we do is put the insulation down over the old asphalt surface, and the aggregate is then put upon it. You can see there we're using a two-layer. Oh, thank you, sir. And after 3 years, that's what the road bed looked like. You want to do it? I guess it's... Okay, go ahead. So after all this testing and installation, we've been able to come up with a family of acceptable designs. Thickness of gravel versus insulation thickness. And basically, when it gets right down to it, and we're talking dollars, and what happens is it's the savings that the insulation product's going to give you over the aggregate. And I know as you go farther north in Alaska, aggregate is very, very, very expensive, and the insulation becomes less expensive. We see more of it, especially up in Prudhoe Bay, out at Kotzebue, or not Kotzebue, out at Pollard. And the cost of gravel nowadays is a little bit more, especially in Alaska. It's down below 48. But the same percentages relate to it. Okay. I know that up in Prudhoe, the oil people, the environmental impact part of water, and also DOT aviation. Is anybody here from DOT aviation? No? This is a real problem to get into and work on there, because where do you get the aggregate when you're working out at Deering or Buckland? To get the proper kind of aggregate, you build the proper kind of bed. And so consequently, and sometimes you have to haul it a long ways. Also, you can't retrieve a lot of aggregate out of the rivers anymore. Not real good gravel up the Prudhoe anymore. So consequently, what we can do is substitute some of that aggregate with the insulation. I always use kind of a rule of thumb, don't quote me on this, but as we start with 1 foot of gravel, just 1 inch of styrofoam, and we kind of work our way up. But as you can see, the conventional insulation reduction of 20% and a gravel land required, gravel resource for conventional insulation reductions up to 60. So, we've done a number of applications up here. This was along on the haul roads during the time of the pipeline. And this is right over the tundra. And one of the things that you don't want to do when you get in a permafrost, especially like up there, is don't disturb. So consequently, you can see that the styrofoam is going right down over the top of the permafrost. And we're starting to build the road over the top. Maybe it's kind of a long shot. Again, two-letter system. Staggering all the joints. That was basically the finished line of it. This is at Anchorage International Airport, where we get some aprons and taxiways. Same concept. Just another one there. This is out in Kotzebue, a while ago. Same application. The polyethylene is nothing but what the insulation is wrapped in. Instead of trying to take it off and throw, we just bury it right into the system. And probably one of the bigger uses right now in Alaska is we're doing the same concept that oil people are to build their oil pads, to set their rigging on. It's kind of interesting. A couple of the oil people have come up to where we're using styrofoam and timber so we can reuse the bags. really kind of interesting. And we just started that at the end of last year, so we'll see what happens in the future. We'll be able to actually transport the camera. About 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we got the Baltimore Alaska Railroad. The same situation, same problems with the permafrost or seasonal frost problems, jacking up the railroad. And so we came in and did the same concept in certain areas up near Fairbanks under the railroad. And all we did is lifted. You can see the styrofoam laying underneath there, put the aggregate, and dropped the railroad right back down on top of it. This is just some of it was delivered. Same principle as we started out with. Preserve the road depth. The other thing, too, is that we've gotten into a lot of, in this area, too, is the insulated utility lines. And typically, up in this country, we have to dig our lines almost 4 feet down. And if you insulate it, with the concept of doing, we can do the same thing and only have to go about 2 feet. So there's some savings and some things that go on. All we're doing is the same principle. We're lining the trench with the insulation and putting the pipe in some kind of a slurry around the pipe. And each design group has different ways of putting different slurries around it. They sure do. They sure do. In fact, the people that take care of the pipeline have got some really neat designs using this system. It's a little bit more sophisticated than this. It will probably be done in, this year on some of the underground pipeline. It's also some problems for them. And, very simple and fairly inexpensive to do it. We actually have made, we only do it on special, but we have curved the styrofoam to fit around that kind of a curved pipe to fit it so that there's no air movement and whatnot around it to keep it. We also make a product that is 125 PSI product. It's called HD1623, whatever that means. But anyway, it's for tremendous loadings, and we put it underneath like this bridge pillar here. And that's with the forms off of it. You can see the rigid insulation sitting down below it. Basic finished product there to stop that temperature change underneath of it on the foundation. We've also used it underneath towers, utility towers, so that we don't get the legs sinking way down. And one of the other areas that we use it is also in bridge embankments where we're coming right up to it, and that is that always ends up being somewhat of a tricky situation depending on what kind of soils you get into. But there's a lot of loading right there. You tend to get that problem over the years where the road doesn't match up with the bridge. And because the lightness of the rigid insulation, we're able to come in and stabilize the situation and put the aggregate around it. It looks somewhat like that. So anyway, I had to throw that one in. I mean, Big Highways in Alaska, we've been involved with your people for a number of years, and right now, you can turn the lights back on. We started all the way back in 1959 and kind of brought you up to where we are today, but not really, because in the last 3 years or so, there have been some very good improvements in rigid insulation. Characteristics of them. I think we know a lot more that's going on with rigid insulations, and I think we're going to be able to provide people with a lot better product than we did way back in 1959. In fact, I know even 1966. 74 was a change, and we just had some formulation change in 82. So, you have any questions? Yes, sir.
I understand that we were told last year with the DOT that one of the reasons they don't use the insulation embankment up here is because of the whole harmless agreement that the state require, or that they now coming.
I knew someone was going to bring that up. Or
I wonder what.
Every time I go to Fairbanks, yeah. Anyway, I do. What are you doing here? You know, I'm not a legal man. I'm just a salespeople for this whole thing. start to use them, I wish I could back the slides up, is that what occurs is you get something differential icing, all right? You get a change of condition on your surface, your asphalt, if you would. And this has to do with temperature change. Now, on a conventional road, you're probably going to have more of a heat or more of a freeze. Now, what's happening when you put the insulation in the road bed, you're going to change that, okay? And you're going to alter that, if you would, that energy flow through that embankment. And what can happen is you actually get black ice, is what if you want to just get in layman's terms that occur. The interesting thing about, and there's ways to correct that, you can set your insulation at different levels, put more aggregate on top of it, a less thickness, you want more energy flow through it, more BTU through it, okay? So there's ways to engineer around that. But the interesting thing about it is that even a shady part of the road, which is nature, will do the same thing on a road bed. So it's not just, you know, the styrofoam that's occurring to that. Without getting too far out of school, we have done a lot of work in trying to come up with a system using rigid insulations to try and stop this heaving and moving of the embankment. We're not highway engineers, okay? And we would love to work with you people and help you in every way we can, but we can't take full responsibility, and I think that's where it lies. We can't take full responsibility of the total construction of the road.
The reason I bring that up is there are some legislators here, and if that's causing a problem or keeping us from using that thing, maybe that's something they should be looking at, getting the state to sign a whole harmless agreement.
I think they are. I think there is some movement in that area. And I hope it comes about. I think it's been used up in Alaska for quite a while now. We will place styrofoam underneath any kind of gravel surface because you really don't get the differential icing on that. And boy, there's miles of it up here. And the only time you get into that is into a, you know, an asphalt pavement surface. And that's something that we, that's about as far as anyone. I don't really know much more about it. But the whole harmless has, I think, stopped the progress of a lot of things. The really to really appreciate what we're doing is that, you know, a guy could spend another hour, an hour and a half, and start just looking at the characteristics of insulation, like you did with all the asphalts, so that you can understand why one insulation does what and one doesn't, and you can start to target. There are certain characteristics in rigid insulation that you just have to have, it's going to last. That's very, very prudent. Freeze thaw, perm ratings, compressive. A lot of people just look at compressive strength, and that is only one part of the formulation. It's a very delicate balance to get the right kind of product within the mix of foods and foam. So maybe someday we can address the characteristics of foam too. That's a any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Oh, one other thing I was going to tell you, if you there's nothing in here about whole harmless, but we do have, I brought up a few of these that just kind of briefly goes through kind of what we were talking about, the applications of the original insulation and roads.
Could I ask a question?
Sure, cancer.
How much a mile did the insulation, say, orange insulation, two layers, cost per layer, you know?
And where?
Say, anywhere in Alaska, but realizing it gets should be about the same anywhere. The wage rates are about the same.
How much to lay?
Not
much? On-site cost.
No, I'm talking about if you're displacing gravel, the styrofoam should be fairly constant.
Correct.
Anywhere in the state. But how much mile does it cost to put down 4 inches of styrofoam? You know?
Okay. Well, that's
including product and including labor and the whole thing.
I'm going to sidestep that just a little bit now, but we'll try and come up with the answer. I can give you some examples of the cost. For instance, the Buckland that was done last year, during 2 years ago. Those are very remote areas, and actually the cost of freight to get the material there is more than the actual cost of the insulation. So it really varies. The cost of rigid insulation, styrofoam, okay, which is made in Torrance, California, shipped all the way up here, and for example, in Prudhoe Bay, is about 50 cents a board foot. Now that's 1 inch by 12 by 12. So if you're looking at 4 inches thick, okay, you're gonna $2 a square foot. And you gotta tack another dollar on there, lay in place probably $3. I think that's on the high end a little bit, between $2.75 and $3. That's probably the most extreme condition. That's way up there. And really, if you're looking at cost comparison, just building a pad 5, 6, 7 feet high to protect the permafrost, and that's really what we're doing. All we're doing is we're, you know, ground hazards.
You're doing that in Prudhoe Bay, but not in South Central.
We're not doing it in South Central. We have done utility down here, and quite a bit of it. But we have not done, to my knowledge, any kind of substitution of aggregate for sharp.
Even along Turnington Arm, that was not substituted.
That's the South Central. I'm sorry, I thought you meant Southeast. Oh, yes. And also the Minnesota Exchange, that we just bid, it's got rigid insulation in certain areas.
How much does gravel cost in Anchorage?
About $22 a foot.
$22.
But that depends on what kind of aggregate, too. See, but when an engineer sits down to determine this, what he does is he's got to feed all these factors in.
For a general figure, I looked at that from the DOT, and talking somewhere in the 400,000 miles.
Four inches or so.
And it may not make sense.
Doug, I want to tell you how much we appreciate it. I'm glad to see some of those sites that a lot of us recognize, too, as part of your styrofoam soil insulation materials. Tom, we've been waiting to see your high-float emulsions. Tom Newneighbor, if I don't screw your name up, Tom. Field Operations Engineer, Federal Highway Administration, U.S. Department of Transportation. He's going to give us a show here on the high-float emulsions. We have, in the past legislature, the last year's session, we okayed some high-float emulsion testing and operations in the state. And I think perhaps that it's going to work. They won't tell me which part of the road they've done it up in Fairbanks area, but I think it's out on one of the roads out in the North Pole area. I'm going to try to find out which one it is. Half of it. The other half is conventional stuff. Tom, I don't want to steal any of your thunder, so it's all yours.
Last not in, in Canada. That's the picture up on the Ames Road, way just prior to striping, with asphalt put down, chips on top, it was a pretty good running surface, and this pavement had only been down about 4 months or so at the time this picture was taken. That's another close-up of some of the work that the Yukon Territorial Government did, showing that it does give a pretty good asphalt surface treatment. It doesn't always turn out to be a perfect job. Like anything else, you don't do it right. Here there's at least 4 things that were done wrong here. I don't know if I need to go into all the details of the construction problems on this, but we pretty well got most of the problems worked out after watching the Yukon government and the Northern Public Works Canada in Northern British Columbia. For 2 years before we did any of it ourselves, we were able to avoid most of the problems they had. In this case, they've got drilling and flushing and too heavy overlapping joints and a few other things that caused the problem that you see here. This flushing of the material here, the aggregate is all still there. It looks like the aggregate has been whipped off the surface. In reality, it is not. There, all of the aggregate was placed there at the time that the job was done, and it looked pretty good at the time. All that aggregate is still there. The traffic has since beat the aggregate down into the asphalt, and the asphalt has come to the surface around. This is typical, although it wasn't the case here. The case here was the action of asphalt right at that point. But the same type of a surface texture, the flat, select surface, is what you get if you use this same mix and even do the job right in an area where you have many truck turning movements. You get extremely heavy truck traffic or a lot of turning. You end up with slick pavement because the material is soft. During the hot summer periods, the trucks just continually work the aggregate down into the asphalt until you have this type of a situation. Some of the other things you have to watch, like here, they overlap their joint too heavy. When they put the piece on the right was put down maybe 2 hours before the picture was taken. That on the left was put down, cars down in 3 segments across the road, and we've got some heavy joints right here. Here, those are places where the joint overlap too much. It's put down pretty much like any other asphalt surface treatment, except that we use a graded aggregate rather than a clean chip. By graded aggregate, I mean there's a uniform grading from a 3/4 inch aggregate chip right down to fine dust. -200 material is usually about 5%. So it looks like a dirty aggregate is what we're using, which is what is required for this type of mix because it adds to the overall stability of the surface. The clean chips here probably, from what they tell us, would be a big disaster. Clean chips, 5/8 chip with nothing bigger than 5/8 and nothing smaller than 1/2 inch, is what you would normally use with what most people think of as a surface treatment. The asphalt was put down as a method. The asphalt is the high flow emulsion. In this case, it has about 8% cutback. So it's a cutback asphalt emulsified with water sprayed out on the road. Immediately behind that, we come along with our chip spreader and dump the chips right into it. We've shot some different jobs where we were doing that. See, that follows the distributor quite close. The stops and waits for the chip spreader to catch up. I've been told that it doesn't really hurt if the asphalt is down for as long as a couple hours. They said it's still, the final product looks the same. We tried our best to avoid that, tried to keep the asphalt fairly close and let it get way out ahead of us. Part of the problem that occurred had to do with this wave that pushes ahead of the curtain of aggregate. Because the places where we had high super elevation, that wave actually started flowing off into the ditch on the down super side, on the inside of the curb. Also, when you stop, that wave doesn't start out again immediately when you change tracks and start up again. So you have a tendency to run over with the aggregate. That means a heavy bump in the road before you start pushing the wave ahead again. They've developed a comb arrangement now that goes under the stream of aggregate so that fits right into the curtain of aggregate. It's a comb arrangement with the tines pointing ahead. The large aggregate hits, bounces ahead, the tines drop right through, breaking up that stream of aggregate. The telescopic got all these problems solved. They're caused by that wave. So it's just in the last couple of years, they seem to come up with solutions to some things that were causing us considerable problems in 1981. That's one of the bumps where they stopped and then started out again. We took precautions on the Haines Road project to not have any of this happen. You do see quite a bit of this in Watson Lake. A couple hundred miles south of Watson Lake, projects down that way, before they finally realized that there wasn't that curing it. This is part of that asphalt that just runs to the side. It wasn't quite running into the ditch there. That's what the close-up of the asphalt looks like, and just as it's beginning to break, is the water and the asphalt are beginning to separate. This is only, in fact, it has hardly begun to break there. It's still pretty brown looking, and the distributor is probably only 30 feet or so away. The distributor started out, and the chip spreader was right behind it. That's what the aggregate looks like. It's green and aggregate. That's what the bulk of the Alaska Highway looks like in southern Yukon and northern British Columbia. It's hundreds of miles of road. It looks just like that now. They have put this type of emulsion on very successfully, and with the exception of a few problems, mostly caused by water under the surface, the Alaska Highway is a paved road just about all the way from Fairbanks to the South 48 now. There's only a few short segments that have not had this treatment. The reason they haven't driven that treatment is that the schedule for reconstruction is going to cease. So either under construction, scheduled for construction this year, or they have this type of surface treatment pretty well taking the curse off of the Alaska Highway. Some of the problems they are having, there's a piece of the same road taken in a rainstorm. There's what the surface looks like when there's no pushing of the asphalt through. Very good skid resistance for that type of the road. I mean, better skid resistance than almost any type of a pavement surface. Some of the problems were directly related to moisture under the road or lack of compaction. In this case, the road had been straightened out. The road, up until a few months before, had been off to the left of the picture there. They rebuilt through the little bit of a swale here. Did not get proper compaction under the road, and have something under this, of course, on the whole left. It's 3/4 of an inch thick. And when we put this on the road, whatever strength we had there before is what we have after. The strength of a bituminous surface treatment was so little that I haven't heard of it, and that there would be major. It's not like when you add 2 or 3 or 4 inches of patent pavement, you actually are adding quite a bit of strength to the pavement structure. The bituminous surface treatment of any type, either a type O or any of the other emulsions or paving grade asphalt or whatever you might be using, do not add any strength to the pavement itself. The 3 inches of patent, of course, adds considerably to the strength. There's another section where the roadway is only about 6 or 8 inches higher than the ground off to either side. Back off to the left may have to be a little higher in places. The water comes in, saturates the subgrade, and of course the pavement falls all apart. There's another place where they went back in and out. They got a bunch of muddy material and backfilled it with a better grade of gravel. And of course, they got a 1/4 mile over there that they didn't try to put a surface treatment back on until the following year. They put it on there, got some moisture, and it immediately fell all apart. And of course, if it all goes well, this is the type of surface we expect to have on the time. This is the picture taken up near Haynes Junction. What we recommend this for, or any of the surface treatments, is in areas for interim pavement, like this Coke project that we saw earlier, that they're going to rebuild. That's coming up this year. That road probably will take several years to reach thermal equilibrium over some of the permafrost areas and some of the easing areas. During the time that it's taking to reach thermal equilibrium or to reach a new stability, and meanwhile it's probably going to get a lot of these dips back into it, this would make a good interim surface. Because it does the cracks, if it gets a crack in it, during warm weather, the cracks will all right shut again. It's soft enough material, the crack will roll back shut and keep the grade sealed, keep the moisture out of it. So on a road like the Cove, where we can expect problems, when you put this on, the little rolls and dips that it gets, the road would bend with it, it wouldn't all break out because of the subgrade deformations. So that's one of the places that we would be recommending a surface treatment, and the high foam would work quite well there. Subdivision, high traffic subdivision, where primarily automobiles. Or a 20-year life. Normally, the bigger your pavement structure is years. This is good for, with a good base center, probably in the range of 5 to 8 years. So if you were going to compare the costs, it's probably better to go with, you know, once you get your deformation, you don't have all the pavement, go to your permanent pavement. We're still recommending you go with the regular plant mix for your long-term pavement.
Problems you had with it, though, are when the subbase is not constructed properly.
Quite a bit of the Alaska Highway, like that section southeast of Watson Lake, it's really nothing more than a mud road. They put maybe 3 or 4 inches of gravel over it over the years, and then have scarified that down into the subgrade. So it's primarily a mud road. But even there, this held up very well, as long as they had good ditches along the side.
Okay.
As long as it was good drainage, even over a road that had virtually no base rock, it's doing quite well. Some of that has been down now, I first went up there, it was 78. Some of it had been down 4 years already there. And we're looking at 8 or 9 years, and it's just now beginning to show some distress. And they told us all along, 5 to 8 years is what they expect. They've already gotten 8 years and still in reasonably good shape.
Is there any areas of Alaska with the climate that you would not recommend?
It doesn't work very well in extremely hot climates because of the high penetration, the soft class of asphalt. Around Haines Junction, we got some 85 degree weather within a week after we put it down. And coming through it, that we had to go back and redust the surface of the road to make sure it didn't pick up on hard tire. As soon as it cooled down again to the normal summer temperature range in that area of around 60-70 degrees, that problem ceased to exist. And the next year, when the temperatures came up again, by that time it had cleared out to the point where it didn't cause any problems the next year. Now, they have used some of this even in Arizona and a number of the southern states, but they use a 150 penetration rather than the 350. And even there, I understand they've only used it in the mountainous areas. So it's not recommended at all for hot climates. And we're putting in a project this summer on the Mud Bay Road out of Haines. And that project calls for 4 different types of treatment. 2 with the high float emulsions, 2 with a different classification of emulsion, 1 recommended by Chevron as a comparison. And part of that's to be primed, part of it's to be unprimed with the base. So that's one of the projects we'll be looking at now here to get a comparison. We really can't compare the prices on this job, though, with the prices at the beginning in Alaska and the Canadian jobs today, because this is a very small job set up as an experiment, and the prices were rather outrageous by comparison. But really, we didn't expect exceptionally good prices on this job because of the way it's set up. It's going to be expensive for a contractor to put down in this particular case because of the parameters. Yes, yes.
Would the aggregate be less expensive too because of the
it costs about the same to produce as the normal aggregate would be used in a plant mix, where the chips, the clean chips, are quite a bit more expensive. As a matter of fact, some of the prices the BC government gave us indicated that the clean chips could be as much as triple in cost.
In your comparative section,
I think they're using a clean chip on the ESG. They're using whatever Chevron, I don't know.
What's the question?
On the test section at Haines, they are using a clean chip in the emulsion that
they using the same chips on both the CMS 2 and the and
well, yeah, I understood that they were using the D1.
Yeah, I don't see how you can make a comparison if you don't use the same thing.
Chip on both of them based on that.
Now, that D1 aggregate is almost on the exact same spec as what we were using on Haynes Road.
The idea was to try to make the same comparison that we've done other places with the high floats so that the DOT engineers can make an appraisal and see if the experience that we've had other places comparing the two will result here in Alaska.
D1 chip.
Yeah, well, it's a graded material from 1 inch all the way down to some percent. Got the 6 max past the 2 inches.
You make this motion and Nikiski.
Which motion are you speaking of?
The high float.
We can, but Kevin is taking it. Well, we can, yes. In fact, we were, 40 years ago, this was the motion we were making. We didn't call it high float, but it's an agenda.
Yeah, go right ahead, Don. I just...
On our resolution last year that we set out where we requested the department to do some experimentation with this. I understand that there has been up in your area some secondary road, I believe, selected.
Yeah, off Pegger Road. And I think maybe Dave might mention that when he comes up here. Are you gonna?
I just wanted to know if we had three areas that we asked for that to happen, one in southeast, one in south central, one in
interior.
In interior, if they had actually selected this area in south central or southeast.
Well, I don't know about south central or southeastern, but I do know that we have got one selected in the Fairbanks area on one of the service roads there. And I don't know whether Dave's going to tell us about it or not when he comes up. But I do want to thank Tom for his presentation. Each time I get a little more out of it. I think this is about the third time I've seen it. But it's more interesting each time. And I appreciate that very much. And hopefully that type of work that comes out with this high-float emulsion, it could very well, maybe that could be some of our farm roads and stuff like that. And without too much more, I'd like to ask Dave Ash to come up. He's Alaska Department of Transportation on research. We're running short of time, but I think it's been well worth running over a little bit, some of the data we've got. So, Dave, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Senator.
One other thing I might mention before Dave gets started. Speaker Joe Hayes and Representative Cato, Representative Cato is here now. I hope you recognize him. As chairman of the House Transportation, Speaker Hayes is supposed to be in and will speak right after. Did he make it in, Dave?
No, he did not.
He didn't, okay. Then we may shorten our little deal here. We'll talk about it in a minute.
See, when I received the invitation to talk a bit about what the DOT is doing in highway research, I had a pretty wide range of topics to pick from. We have currently, just in our highway studies program, about 58 different projects that are active. So, you can understand that I was forced to pick some highlights primarily, and that's about all I try to do here is to hit some points that I feel are our pressure points at the present time in our research program. I did look over our research studies program and where we're spending our money, and I find that out of our current year's program, which is mostly funded by federal highways money, funded from a portion of the highway construction dollar with a budget of about $500,000. that's a fairly steady item year to year. We are spending about 40% of that on permafrost research. Somewhere around 15% of it on the particular problem is trying to get fish to pass our roadways and their trips upstream without aggravated biologists. Some 12% on highway safety, slippery road problem. Another approximately 20% on bridge and river studies, and the remnant money on pretty much on pavement performance at various sites. Just give you a little view of the way we've broken the research section. Three responsibility areas: highway research, energy and buildings, and transportation systems. Transportation systems was everything else that didn't fit into the first two categories. I'll talk only about the first category here, highway research. This plot shows how we spend our research dollar. Somewhere around 10% of it is spent with federal and state agencies for assistance in research. Around 25% of it to university-related research, most of that to the University of Alaska. Another 25 or 30% to in-house research, and the remainder to private consultants, primarily the private sector. Again, this is not coming through very clearly. I'll just relate it for you. The goals, basically, that we're aiming at in the highway research program, the first one, eliminate springtime load restrictions on truck routes. It's a tough problem, but it is something we would like to see licked on certain routes because we can see major aggravations to the trucking industry and to the public when we slap our spring load restrictions. Second area, increase wintertime safety without causing vehicle corrosion. And this is an area we'll talk about briefly. The attempts to eliminate the road salt, which chews the fenders off of your car and attacks our bridges. Next area, reduce highway roughness due to permafrost. And that's, again, back to the permafrost problem. Permafrost would not be a problem if roads did not become rough. Increase pavement life and apply life cycle costing to pavement design, next one, and reduce design and construction costs is the last one. Okay. This device is a test unit. We have purchased two of these now to provide us with amount of information never before available on the strangular edge structures. This lets us determine what load restrictions should be put on a route, whether that route can sustain overload, and most probably how long that pavement structure will last under various traffic levels. We have one of these in Anchorage, present time, and one in Fairbanks. We purchased one in 82 and one in 83. This just briefly shows how the load is distributed through the pavement and down to a base course. And the concept here is that the highest loads are right at the top of the pavement, and the pavement itself spreads the loading quite a bit as you get down to the bottom of the pavement. And this shows in diagrammatic form how a pavement fails. The areas look at there, I don't know what this part of the ring up here. Quite, but your first crack tends to form underneath the wheels at the bottom of the pavement, so that it's a problem in determining when a pavement has started to fail. If it cracks from the bottom up, you don't know it until it's cracked all the way through, a normal situation. So you need information on the strength of the pavement. You need to make some projections from strength to see what has really happened. This shows results of some annual inventories that we do. Each year we observe very closely half of our road system, so that every 2 years we cover our entire state system. We measure the cracking and the patching, and we're showing in this plot how that has varied over three different years, 78, 1980, and 1982. The red, the left bar being 78, blue 80, and the green 82. Now, the reason why cracking them go up or down would relate to the rate at which we're fixing our pavements or overlaying them with new pavement structures. If we are overlaying faster than we are cracking them up, we're ahead of the game. And if our reconstruction program lags, we wind up with worse and worse conditions. This plot was done on the Parks Highway, and it intends to show how much remaining life we have on different parts of that route. Again, it's a bit difficult probably from your distance back there with this small size of screen to see, but the primary point to be made from this is that we now have data, particularly on the parks, and develop with this falling weight test device that will tell us which pieces of that route are adequate for existing loads, which parts have already outlived their useful life and are effectively in a failed condition. The Parks Highway